Hello and welcome to Playback. On this week's programme, we hear about the impact the fodder crisis is having on Irish farmers.
Just coming into the farmyard, listening to animals bawling, it is very difficult for farmers to actually listen to. They're just struggling day to day, and the morale is very low as well.
Reaction to the Luis Suarez biting incident.
What we've seen yesterday shouldn't be seen on a football field. You know, that was a game that was shown worldwide. There was kids all around the world who looked up to Luis Suarez as a footballer.
Advice on how we should be conditioning our daughters to be leaders of the future.
You know, the next time anyone's about to call their little girl bossy, take a deep breath and say instead, my daughter has executive leadership skills.
And 10 years on, to celebrate its birthday, the John Murray Show has a bit of a sing-song inside the belly of the spire on O'Connell Street.
Poor old Admiral Nelson is no longer in the air. Tooraloo.
But first, the Bank of Ireland AGM on Wednesday was a lively gathering. Not surprisingly, the subject of Chief Executive Richie Boucher's annual salary of €840,000 was a major talking point amongst the attendees, who spoke to Drive Time's Brian Lally as they emerged from the meeting.
Well, somebody said to me that if he was in overseas that he'd get €1.5 million. But I think that he, as an act of contrition, he should work for a few years at €500,000 and put the thing right, and then he'd be entitled to get it. I mean, the people like Joe Welch getting €90,000 for being chairman of the Remuneration Committee, that's extraordinary. And then the chairman getting €450,000, nearly €500,000.
How have you been affected yourself?
Complete and total disaster. I was advised to put my money into blue chips, Anglo-Irish, Bank of Ireland and AIB, and I've lost 3 shorts.
How do you keep a smile on your face?
Well, I've overcome it. I had a nervous breakdown, but I'm overcoming it.
What's your thought about the proposed salary arrangements for the
it's
CEO?
Ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. They're up there and people are bringing it up, but it's water off a duck. Joe Walsh is on a committee now, and because he's the chairman, he gets an extra €20,000. They must have got that from the Dáil, because every committee in the Dáil, if you're a chairman, you get an extra €20,000 as well. So he's doing nicely with his big fat pension.
You're on the way to Punchestown.
Yeah.
You might be better off putting the money on a horse.
The returns would be better even at a 10-1 on shot. You get 10% back if he wins, you know what I mean? You won't get much in the bank. You get about 1% in the bank, you know?
You pay for what you get, and if we're paying good salaries to men, and if they do a good job, maybe it's one of the best investments put into the country, little mind the banks.
What do you think of the proposed salary arrangements?
Absolutely
for the...
Absolutely ridiculous. When everybody is just taking huge cuts, shoving on thousands upon thousands onto their pay, that's not fair. Couldn't be.
Have you been affected by the share collapse?
Robbed. I was a rich man one time, you know.
It's all gone.
It's all gone.
As a very small shareholder, sold my business, put my money into bank shares, and here I am retired, and I can't do any of the things I wanted to do. But yes, the directors are getting large salaries. They can do what they want to do.
From Brian Lally's report on Drive Time on Wednesday. Another subject which received a lot of coverage in the airwaves this week was the fodder crisis and the hardship being endured by farmers, many of whom simply haven't enough money to feed their livestock. On Thursday's Today with Pat Kenny, Valerie Cox visited Michael Doran's 300-acre farm in Duncormac, County Wexford.
There's two problems that we have. The first problem is the summer that we had last year, it wasn't actually a summer. The rain started the June bank holiday weekend. A lot of people didn't get an opportunity to cut their silage then at that stage. It ran late, the quality of it was very bad. People had to start feeding it, myself included, last year from June onwards. So we were depleting into our winter fodder stocks at that stage. Normally I wouldn't start feeding animals in the shed until October. I had 3 months of equivalent of my fodder used at that stage because of the amount of animals that were in the shed last summer, on and off. You were trying to get them back out the grass whenever the ground conditions would improve again, but just because of the saturation that was there, we just physically weren't able to graze it. The second problem then is we didn't have a spring this year. Normally grass growths at this stage would be skyrocketing, and we would be growing more than enough, and we'd be actually growing surplus grass more than we could actually consume for the animals, and we'd be putting that, what the surplus, we'd be putting it aside for silage, to make silage in the month of June to conserve for next winter. The soil temperatures have only in the last 10 days gone above 10 degrees, and you really need them above that 10 degrees to really for the grass to take off. But take today again, we're back on with coats again. The temperatures, there's just a chill in that breeze. Grass is not going to grow in that sort of cooler conditions and that wind that's there. Also, over the last 3 weeks, there's been some very heavy rain in short periods of time, and has made ground conditions saturated as well. So what little grass is there, animals are actually walking it into the ground rather than actually eating it.
Michael, are you fairly typical of farmers in this area?
I suppose I could say that I'm not as bad off as an awful lot of people, and I would acknowledge that there's an awful lot of people way worse off than I am, because I'm able to get some animals out the grass and we're trying to stretch it as best we can. I have straw on the farm, we have tillage on the farm, so I have some straw on the farm, and instead of using the straw to bed the animals, we're actually using it to feed them, which is something that normally we would never do. But there is some people really struggling to get by day to day. Just coming into the farmyard, listen to animals bawling. It is very difficult for farmers to actually listen to. They're just struggling day to day, and the morale is very low as well. And I think that's the biggest challenge we face. We hear of an increase in suicides taken on farms at the moment. It's something I hate talking about, because I think it's a subject that's very difficult for people to talk about and open up about. But I think it is something that we need to just keep an eye out on our neighbours. Everyone is in the same position. 90% of the farmers that I know are struggling to get by day to day at the moment. We're all hoping for that week of really fine warm weather where the grass will actually take off and start growing. If grass started growing, we would actually, our spirits would pick up as well.
From Valerie Cox's report on Today with Pat Kenny on Thursday. Sports coverage this week was dominated by controversy. The Luis Suarez biting incident, for which he subsequently received a 10-match ban for biting Chelsea defender Branislav Abramovich during a match on Sunday, was a big story throughout the week. On Monday's News at 1, Ray Houghton, RTE soccer analyst and former Liverpool striker, gave his reaction to Sean O'Rourke.
I think they paid £23 million for him, and probably on the market at the moment, he's probably worth double that. So they're not going to let him go for nothing, that's for sure. And if he does go in the summer, and there's plenty of talk about it, they'll certainly want some money back on him. Now, it's unfortunate. Louis shouldn't have done what he did. You can't defend him at all. Now, the club have acted very strongly. They came out and were very critical of him. They've fined him. They're now going to wait for the report from the FA to see exactly what punishment they're going to dish out to him. I would imagine it's going to be a ban for some length of time. And we'll see where we go from there.
How long is that length of time likely to be, Ray? Because, again, it's one of these attributes of sport which people find absolutely repulsive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's got form for this, isn't he? He actually did it in his last game for Ajax. I think it was against PSV over in Holland. And he got a 7-match ban for that. So you can only go along the same lines that, you know, the FA will look at it. They know there's a template already with the punishment that he's had. And it could be quite near that, you know, 6 or 7 games. He's already missed quite a few last season after the incident with Patrice Evra. And it's something that he has to, you know, learn very quickly from. He's a talented player, but as many persons have said about Liverpool, there's no one bigger than the club. You know, players come and go, but the club still remains, and it's still a fantastic club to be associated with. And Louis should feel very honoured that he's been able to play for the club. But he has to start acting in a grown-up manner now, what we've seen yesterday. Shouldn't be seen on a football field. You know, that was a game that was shown worldwide. There was kids all around the world who looked up to Luis Suarez as a footballer. But there's no place for going around biting an opponent on a football
field. Yeah, but I mean, they fine him and they say strong things. But I mean, there have to be surely some inherent values that apply to sport, and particularly to a club like Liverpool, like Liverpool, with all its tradition. And maybe a point comes where you say, look, sorry, no matter how good he is, no matter how much box office attaches to him, we're not going to have a guy like this on the books. And they're not taking that stance.
That might happen. That certainly might happen. I don't think it's the end of the story.
Ray Houghton talking to Sean O'Rourke on Monday. Although Punchestown began this week, racing coverage was dominated by another controversy, the admission made by Mahmoud Al-Zarouni that he had administered steroids to 15 horses under his care at Haymarket. The admission resulted in an 8-year ban from racing, and on Friday's Morning Ireland, they carried a statement made by Godolphin racing manager Simon Crisford.
We are deeply sorry, because he was our trainer. I think it'll take a very long time for Godolphin to regain the confidence of the public. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that this has taken place before. We were completely unaware of this, and of course we are shocked and completely outraged by the actions that he has taken.
From Friday's Morning Ireland. The collapse of a 9-storey building in a busy market area in Dhaka in Bangladesh this week resulted in the death of more than 100 people. On Wednesday's Drive Time, journalist Morshed Ali Khan spoke to Mary Wilson about the rescue operation and the conditions which allow such accidents to happen.
There are hundreds more still waiting in front of that building as the rescuers try to bring out more corpses, more live bodies, you know. Our culture is quite emotional culture, you see, and people, you know, cry.
And sadly, this is not an unusual occurrence in Bangladesh because of inferior buildings.
This is not. We are really fighting a very serious thing here, you know, while, you know, these are exporters of garments, fisheries, they're having a good time exporting lot of producers to Europe and America. When it comes to the safety of the workers, they're not investing anything. I think this is not a healthy sign for the future of this country.
Are there children working in these places?
That's a difficult question. You know, the workers look like children, mainly because they're so malnourished. They have been so poorly fed since they were born. But most of them, child labor in the garments factory has not been taking place in the country as far as we know, because everyone seeking a job there has to produce a birth certificate issued by relevant authorities.
And are you able to give us some idea of what the average weekly wage is in dollars or in euro for somebody working in the garment industry in Bangladesh?
Let me calculate this. They earn about $40 a month.
About $40 a month.
Every day doing a shift of at least 8 hours.
From Wednesday's Drive Time. Having heard that report about the kind of conditions and wages endured by factory workers in Bangladesh, I couldn't help but make a global retailing comparison between it and Conor McMorrow's report on Morning Ireland on Thursday, in which he reported on the growing number of middle-class Chinese tourists coming to Ireland on shopping sprees.
你好,我是Maria,欢迎光临,你说要帮忙吗?
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Brown Thomas.
That's Maria, one of the Mandarin-speaking store assistants at the Brown Thomas store on Dublin's Grafton Street. It is one of the Irish businesses attempting to capture a slice of the lucrative Chinese tourist market. Mark Limby is the store manager.
We've done quite a lot to try and accommodate in the past couple of years the Chinese customers. We have the China Union card, which is really helpful for Chinese customers in making payments. We also have had specific recruitment for Mandarin speakers in store, and that's been really successful. Now we have over 30 Chinese speakers in Mandarin and Cantonese as well for us. And even with our resident Irish team, they've all had some small training on how to welcome Chinese customers as well.
So, 你要找什么啊?
Maria is selling a Celine handbag at the store. It retails at €1,400 in Dublin and just under €2,000 in Beijing. Some luxury products are cheaper in Ireland, so demand is high among Chinese visitors.
So far this year already, we're just over 20% up on our Chinese sales from outside Chinese customers coming in and as tourists. And we do see that the luxury brands are very popular for us.
Lucy is from the northeastern coast of China. She has been living in Ireland for 10 years and understands the appeal of the luxury market to Chinese tourists.
There is a massive saving to shopping in European countries for the European luxury brands. The savings can be up to 40%. They intend to go for all the high brands like Louis Vuitton, Prada, Chanel, Hermes, Gucci, fashion brands and some fine jewellery brands as well.
Last year, Xi Jinping, who is now president of China, visited Ireland. Images of the visit were watched by millions and one Irish tourist attraction has been reaping the dividends ever since. Catherine Webster is the director of the Cliffs of Moher Visitor Experience in Clare.
In February of last year, when Mr. Xi Jinping, he was then Vice Premier of China, he's now Premier of China, was visiting Ireland, we'd been approached by the Chinese embassy to include the Cliffs of Moher on his visit, and he came to see us as part of the visit. And the photographs that were taken at the Cliffs of Moher must have been very widely published in China, because in the following year, ever since then, we've had a substantial number of Chinese tour groups coming along, and the Chinese visitors all say they want to have their photograph taken in the same spot as Mr. Xi.
From Thursday's Morning Ireland. Also on that same programme, we heard another story about how criminal gangs are targeting and stealing from charity clothes collection bins all over Ireland. Riches from Rags was the first programme broadcast by RTÉ's new investigative unit on Thursday night. Reporter and head of that new unit, Paul Maguire, told Cathal McQuilla about how the programme monitored the activities of one of these gangs based in Meath and Kildare.
Every night, anything up to four or five vans will head out on very organised routes. They'll crisscross right across the whole country, the 26 counties. In 7 days, they targeted 800 bins.
And this all leads down to a container lorry filled in a depot in County Meath, which then heads off literally through Dublin Port. So this is, it's big business
it
in
is,
volume
it's
and
huge
money.
Business, yeah. This one particular gang, in 2 days that we watched, in two consecutive days, two 40-foot containers left the country. That you can imagine that. That was actually close to 30 tonnes of clothes that actually went out.
And you filmed every stage of this operations, and maybe it's not a surprise because it is happening at night, it is happening in sort of places at the back of a shop or in a car park or something. Nobody tries
it's
to
also,
interfere.
It's also actually happening in the, what we found was very funny, it's happening when people are around as well. These gangs are very well organised. They seem to, you know, take huge risks. They drive into car parks and supermarket car parks, will literally drive up to within an inch or two of where the bins are. They'll hide the bins behind their van. In one case in a supermarket in Birr, they broke into the bins at 8 o'clock in the evening, and there were people unloading the shopping out of their trolleys into the boot of their car, literally a couple of metres away.
Paul Maguire of RTÉ's new investigative unit on Thursday's Morning Ireland. Monday's Live Line opened with a call from Pauline, whose son Jonathan died recently from his heroin addiction, after a long battle on Pauline's behalf to get treatment for her son.
I don't want any mother to be feeling the way I'm feeling today. I'm shaking all through me ever since I found him dead. On the 6th of April, Saturday morning, 9:30, I went in to call him to go to the clinic, and there was no response. And I called him again. I said, come on, my love, get up. You have to get up. I said, you have to go to the clinic. I said, it's Saturday today. They close at 12. And I couldn't. He had no response, and he was lying below in his bunk bed, and I went underneath, and oh my God! When I realised there was no answer, I lifted his head as gently as I could with my two hands, and I begged him to wake up. And I couldn't wake him up, Joe. I couldn't wake him up. And then I started screaming for help, scream. And I grabbed my phone, rang an ambulance. And the fair play to them, they came quickly. They did, and one gentleman came back up the stairs with me and said, you have to go in here, you know, into my own room. And he closed the door while they went in. And a couple of moments later, I sat in the bed and I heard banging. And I said to this gentleman, I said, what's that banging about? I said, are they trying to revive him? Is that what it is? And he didn't answer me, and I was shaking. And I didn't realise they were lifting the bookcase and the linen basket into the bathroom so that they could take him out, you know. And a couple of moments later, I heard them all going down the stairs, and I said to the man, I said, have they been successful? Did they revive him? Is he all right? Is he going to be alive? And then that's when he said to me, no, Mrs., I'm very sorry. He said he's dead. A couple of hours later, I went up to the Mara Hospital. I got a phone call to say they were closing up where they had him in this little chapel room. They were closing it up for the weekend, that they needed a coroner to come in on Monday. And my youngest son took me up, my daughter. And sure, and I went in and seen him on the slab, 45 years of age. So beautiful, honest to God. I tried to wake him up again. I tried to lift him off the slab to bring him home. I said, come on, son, wake up. Come on, let's go home out of here.
From Monday's Liveline. On Tuesday's Today with Pat Kenny, Paddy O'Gorman spoke to some prostitutes working around Arbour Hill in Dublin. One of those he spoke to was a 37-year-old mother of three who's been working as a prostitute for 10 years.
Some people are saying that men who would be your customers should be prosecuted, should be named and shamed.
No, I don't think so. Because any clients that I go with, some of them are divorced. Mm-hmm. Some of them, their wives have died. you know. I'm all right just helping them out, like, everyone needs a bit of fun in their life, you know. Right. And the clients that I have is very good. None of them have, they've always looked after me, you know. And it's not, they're not dirty old man. They're like everyone else, they're only human, you know.
And have you done any jobs so far this evening?
No, not one job, no. Oh.
And normally how much do you get for a job?
Well, it all depends on what they're looking for, you know. So it could be anting up to €70.
And would you take them back to your house for that?
No, Jesus, in the car, like.
And how did you start off doing this kind of work?
A friend introduced me to it because I had bills and I left on my own with the kids. It was easy money, you know.
Well, it's hardly easy, is it?
No, it's not. I'm saying, like, when I started back 10 years ago, it was easy money. You know, I was making €1,000 a night.
These days you wouldn't?
These days, no. With the recession and all, it's gone down, you know.
Right,
you
is know? That a customer I'm keeping you from? I'm sorry.
Know.
Okay, he was looking at you anyway, yeah. We're just around the corner now in the traffic, but is it ever a dangerous job, what you do?
Some of the girls are robbing the clients. They're making it dangerous for themselves. Like, other than that, it's okay.
Do the guards ever cause you any difficulties?
No, the guards just see what you're wearing and make sure you're safe, you know.
So were you ever prosecuted or charged?
Yeah, I was, yeah.
And what happened?
I got a probation.
Does that mean you got fined then?
No, I got 12 months probation.
So for the next 12 months you were...
Oh, it's done and over. That was years ago.
All right, but you still went back out and did the same thing again?
Yeah, because I have kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Right, but you could claim, I suppose, I'm guessing lone parents that you don't have
a... That doesn't... Yeah. My kids are in football and things like that, you know? They have to... And because I'm on my own and other kids come out with the best, the runners and that, you like to put the best runners on your kids as well, you know?
Sure.
From Paddy O'Gorman's report on Tuesday's Today with Pat Kenny. Over on 2FM on Wednesday, Ryan Tuberty spoke to Mia, who also used to work as a prostitute. She told Ryan about how on the 10th of October 2010, she walked away from her life as a prostitute.
At that stage, I had spent 5 years on the Burlington Road, 5.5 years. You know, and I never thought, you know, but weeks turned into months, turned into years.
Sure.
And, I had turned 40 that year, but mainly my daughter had become ill and needed some inpatient care that summer. And during that, her care, I met a healthcare professional who got to know me and just asked me one day, you know, what was life like for me, and listened to me. And because you don't trust anybody when your world is kind of cut off from everybody else's. But anyway, she hung in there. And when my daughter was coming home, she said to me, "Can I make a phone call on your behalf?" And I said, "Yes."
And to whom did she make the call?
Dr. John O'Connor.
Who is?
Who is the clinical director of the Rutland and St. Michael's ward in Beaumont, he also looks after.
So was this a social worker or a healthcare worker, was this the person who caught you?
Yes.
As you were falling into
yes.
the abyss and said, "Whoop, not you."
She wasn't about to let me go. So I didn't just come to a choice. I didn't decide, okay, I've had enough of this. No, it was human intervention that saved me, and it was her.
So what did you do in the last night?
I only did two jobs. And then I looked back at down the Burlington Road, and I just said to it, I will never be back. One way or another, I'm not coming back.
What do you have tattooed on you as a result of all of that?
Oh, 10-10-10, not for sale. Because since the 10th of October 2010, I am not for sale.
Mia, as heard on The Tuberty Show on 2FM on Wednesday. The spire on O'Connell Street is 10 years old this year, and on Tuesday, John Murray, writer Peter Sheridan and engineer Michael O'Neill stepped inside the landmark structure. Before they ventured inside it, John and Peter chatted about icons on O'Connell Street.
I didn't realise that you could actually ascend it. I thought maybe you could get into the very base of it, but I didn't realise that you could go up any distance. That was a huge surprise.
And we have a harness for you, because you're going to go up. You're going to be the brave one to go up a few steps.
Well, seeing that I climbed Nelson's Pillar all those years ago, I suppose I might as well leave my ghostly imprint here again.
Because that was, when you were growing up, that was the monument, the meeting place, Nelson's Pillar.
Well, the two coming-of-age things you could do in Dublin was have your first pint and go up Nelson's Pillar without your mammy. It didn't count who your mammy was with you. But if you went up on your own, that was a real coming-of-age thing, which I did a few times.
And, Michael, you, as I say, you oversaw the construction of the spire. It's 10 years old this year. It's 10th birthday. Take us back to some of the things that happened in the run-up to it becoming what it is today.
We had to take up the base of Nelson's Pillar, so that was the first move. When we got the base up, we found a small granite box inside, which would have been equivalent to a time capsule. When we found it, the guards came and the National Museum came down upon us, right, so they didn't let us touch it at all. So they came in and they took it away and they opened it up in the privacy of their own labs. And they found that there was supposed to be gold coins in it, but there weren't any gold coins in it, right? But the resin was there in the box that the gold coins should have been sank into. And they did find a plaque with all the names of the people who donated towards Nelson's Pillar. And I think Arthur Guinness was one of them, I think, at the time. So that was one of the prominent names, that, and all those were on the plaque. When we get down into the bottom pit now, you'll see that we're in a concrete box, right? And that concrete box sits on 9 piles that go down to bedrock down below the ground.
Peter, you're up there, they reckon, about 20 metres up. Is it high enough for you?
It's definitely high enough for me.
Anyway, you have risen to the task. So you can come on down whenever. I'm even dizzy looking up at you.
Well, it is pretty scary once you start to ascend up there, I have to say. You know, if you're not used to that sensation of being in midair. And that's something I'd be rushing to do every day.
And, Peter, you not only have become the first member of the civilian population to climb the steps here in the middle of the spire, but you're going to perform another first now. You're going to sing us a good old Dublin song to be the first person to sing in the spire. Well, on live radio, anyway.
Well, I've always thought one of the amazing things about the Irish, about us as a race, is, one, that we compose songs about everything. And I remember when the Pillar blew up in 66... that within a week, the Dubliners were singing a song on the stage of the Olympia with Nelson's head beside them on the stage as part of the gig. And the song was, poor old Admiral Nelson is no longer in the air. Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra-loo-ra-loo. On the 8th day of March in Dublin City Fair. Tooraloo-ra-loo-ra-loo-ra-loo. From a stand of bricks and mortar, he fell crashing to the quarter. Where once he stood so stiff and proud and true. So let's sing our celebration. It's a service to the nation. And poor old Admiral Nelson, tooraloo.
From Tuesday's John Murray Show. Now, Crystal Swing might not exactly be the Dubliners of our time, but the family band from Middleton, County Cork, obviously have a unique appeal and following, which attracted the attention of the producers of The X Factor, who recently contacted them to appear in this year's show. But as Mary Murray Burke told Derek Mooney on Monday, her response to the lady from The X Factor was thanks, but no thanks.
I got a call from a lady involved with The X Factor there a few weeks ago, and she, you know, very British lady, and she rang me up and she was literally begging me to come, begging us to come on The X Factor.
What did she say to you when she rang you?
You know, she actually, I was out, I missed the call, and she left a long voicemail for me to call her back. Mm-hmm. She said she was from X Factor. I called her back, and she was just adamant that she wanted us to come on the show.
And
you
when
know?
You spoke to her, she said, I've heard about you, or I've seen your act,
right.
Or what did she say?
Well, she said somebody from the show had seen us on TV and had seen, you know, YouTube videos and all of that, and she felt that we were ideal for the show, for X Factor. But I had in my mind that I just dismissed it, really, and I said no, that we just wouldn't go on at all. You know.
But did
that,
she discuss anything with you? Did she give you any assurances? Did they say, look, we'll pay you if you come on?
Well, she was, we didn't even get that far, Derek, but she was
Mary,
saying,
will you ring her
yeah,
back?
Yeah.
Come on.
I actually think I deleted her number off my phone, because I just, I know it's terrible, Derek. I suppose I suppose really it's just the fear of maybe us being mocked as a family going up there.
But why
do you
think you'd be mocked?
You know, I suppose we did get a little hard time, all right, on Twitter and on YouTube videos
earlier
on.
Everybody does.
For myself, I would brave it, like as Dervla as I would. I'd have said yes there and then, but I thought of Derek and Dervla, you know, because I suppose they're just very genuine people, you know, even though Derek's
so
a very funny guy, but he's really genuine and sensitive. And I guess they just wouldn't feel maybe they could handle, the pressure if it was a negative feedback. But saying that, I said to them, look, we were asked, you know, they must have thought us good enough to go on. Why not give it a bash? But having discussed it, then we just decided let's not go with it.
From Monday's Mooney. On Thursday, Derek had another singer in studio who also has lots of experience of the X Factor, Mary Byrne. The former Tesco employee from Ballyfermot told Derek about how making ends meet over the last couple of years hasn't been easy.
But your first paid gig, I'm surprised at that, Mary. I mean, I would have thought that you would be doing at least one gig a week, one corporate gig a week. But somewhere in Ireland or in the UK, somebody would be having a party and get Mary Byrne.
There was lots
of
offers coming
in. So you get invited
on
to kind of talent shows and guest slots and small
television. Yeah, little bits and pieces like that. But I mean, not paid. Now, Tesco's had one there a while ago and I went on and did that. It was just the finals I did. But I think it was because I wasn't out there. There was nobody to put me out there. Mm. The management had gone and I was kind of still on my Twitter and on my Facebook. I hadn't got control to my Facebook until I got the new management, and then I rang my old manager and we now have control of my Facebook, which is being phenomenal.
So was it the right thing doing X Factor and leaving Tesco? Or, I mean, if you said only one gig, I mean, are you earning enough to keep you going for the year?
Well,
I
had
but are you earning enough to keep you going for
I
the
had
year?
A few bob put away from the X Factor.
Good.
And I am a budgeter anyway, so, I mean, I do watch what I spend. And it's just that comes from years and years of working and just earning small amount of monies. But yeah, I got through. We just took it easy. Deborah's been very good. Deborah, you know, is trying to do, she does a bit of cleaning and stuff like that. And she's been fabulous with paying the rent. And I paid such and such a bill. And, you know, we split the bills between us. But yeah, I had enough to kind of keep me going. But it was starting to dry up very rapidly. So it's time to get back out there. And the people have been, the whole response to me coming back out and getting back out into the public has been phenomenal.
Mary Byrne, as heard on Mooney on Thursday. Rob Carley was one of four inspirational speakers who spoke to an audience of transition year students on the Colm Hay Show on 2FM on Tuesday. The broadcast was part of the show's positive mental health campaign.
My dad was an army officer and we moved to Cork. Right, and when you're young, when you're 10, you pick up an accent really quick. Like, I went to Cork and I wasn't there long. Like, and when I moved back, I was from Cork. So we moved back to the north side of Dublin. And I went to Mount Temple, right? At that time, I just didn't fit in. So I stood in the corridor at the lockers and there was guys in the class called Sculler and Dogger and Boggo and I was like, I'm Robert from Cork, right? And I was terrified. And there was a girl called Jean who was about a foot and a half taller than me, stunning looking, gorgeous girl. And I thought, oh my God, if I fitted in, maybe she'd look at me. The one thing that I had, I used to crack jokes a lot and mess a lot. And then, so suddenly, this girl, Jean, spotted me, right? And I got the word back from her friend. My friend said, right? Now, I know you all say, will you meet them? That was different in our day. If you met someone in our day, you're just shaking their hand. Okay, it was hello, right? This meeting is different now. So we used to say, there was this word say, getting off, right? You got off with someone. So they said, Jean said she'd get off with you if you were taller. And I'm going like, yeah, well, that's not the kind of thing you can just do, right? I'm 6 foot. So basically, she was a foot and a half taller than me and I had to grow. I slept in a grow bag for 7 years trying to get up. And one day, I was within 4 inches of the beautiful Jean, right? And it took me, I was in fifth year when this happened, so it was a long wait, okay? And I was also a member of a minority religion, right? So it was kind of a life where my life was different to everyone else and I didn't go to discos and I didn't drink and I didn't do all the mad stuff. So imagine looking at him like, yeah, big queue of girls waiting to go out with me, I can tell you. So anyway, this girl, Jean, suddenly got interested in me. And on the 25th of September, 1978, but who's counting? I kissed her in the prefect's room in Mount Temple. And on the 6th of September, 2011, she gets up, she kisses me and she says, Rob, I've made a stew for dinner. Right? My favourite food. This is an act of love, right? We will eat this together when I come home tonight. And that day, Jean had an aneurysm and she passed away. And she didn't come home. The wolf of despair was in my house. And I'm going, I cannot go on. But then I remembered who I am and why that matters. Who I am and why that matters. Because there's days in everyone's life, anyone on this panel, anyone you're going to talk to about mental health, there'll be a day when they get up and they go, oh God, does it matter? Can I tell you this? You are lovely, you are lovable, and you are loved, even when you don't think it. You are lovable, you are lovely, and you are loved, even when you don't think it. And Jean told me that nonstop. And because Jean is not here, doesn't make it not true.
Rob Carley has heard on the Colm Hay Show on Tuesday, and it's worth saying that the programme team received an enormous response to Rob's contribution and indeed to that whole programme on positive mental health. Another inspiring speaker was to be heard on last week's The Business. Sheryl Sandberg, Chief Operating Officer of Facebook, has written a book and started a whole new movement called Lean In, Women, Work and the Will to Lead. Here's what she had to say about how the categorisation of women begins from an early age.
You know, the next time anyone's about to call their little girl bossy, take a deep breath and say instead, my daughter has executive leadership skills.
And here's what Sandberg had to say about how there's no denying that men and women are different.
You know, it's funny, you're pointing to biological differences between men and women. And of course, there are many. And I'm not arguing that men and women can ever be innately the same. There are very serious differences between men and women, you know. I breastfed my children. My husband was unable to support me and participate in that activity, right? And so I am not arguing that men and women need to be the same, but I am arguing that leadership is not an innate quality. Leadership that can be feminine as well as masculine. I am not arguing women should be like men. I say in my book that I leave at 5:30 to be home with my children. I say in my book that I've cried in the office. I think leadership can embrace feminine characteristics, masculine characteristics, and by using the full talents of the population, we'll have a broader understanding of leadership and get to better outcomes.
Are you worried at all that maybe you will become defined by feminism rather than by your work?
It's such a good question. And yes, you know, when I first gave a public speak on women, it was about 2.5 years ago, I was invited to give a talk and I was invited to speak on social media and I wanted to speak on issues facing women. And I was told not to, because I was told that once I spoke as a woman, I could no longer be a serious business executive, that you had to be one or the other. And I thought about it and decided I had to do it anyway, because I was watching the progress stall that the data was showing. And I think as women, we need to be able to be both. We need to be able to be advocates for women and feminists and serious professionals. We need to be able to be professionals and mothers if we choose to be. You know, the world assumes that men can be and. They can be interested in things and professionals. They can be have careers and be parents. And so often tries to put women in the or box. You can choose one or the other. And I want the same choices for girls and women that boys and men have, so that we can choose freely what we want to do with our lives.
Sheryl Sandberg, Chief Operating Officer of Facebook and author of Lean In, talking to George Lee on The Business last Saturday. Brian Finnegan, the editor of Gay Community News, is someone you'll often hear talking about issues surrounding gay rights and activism on radio. But on Monday's John Murray Show, he spoke to Shay Byrne about his role as a dad. He told Shay about the day he came out to his 9-year-old son 14 years ago.
We used to go camping quite a lot, just the two of us, and, you know, father-son kind of bonding. Yeah. And the new Harry Potter was out, and so we went to Ross's Point in Sligo, and I bought the new Harry Potter, and we were having a party to kind of celebrate beginning the new Harry Potter together, and because I read to him quite a lot. And so we had Coke and crisps and all the things that kids love, and a tent and a new Harry Potter book. And before we started, I said, you know, do you know what gay is? And he said, yes, I think it's when boys like boys. And I said, yeah, that's right. And I'm gay.
And he just said it straight out. I'm gay.
I'm gay. And he, you know, looked at me and smiled and he said, okay. And I said, do you have any questions? And he said, do boys kiss boys? And I said, yes, some boys kiss boys and some boys kiss girls. And that's the way life is.
Okay.
And he went, okay, start reading.
The order came out to start reading the Harry Potter book. Was there a follow-up conversation after that? Did he come back with questions?
No. He's a quiet boy, Colm, and he's a great boy. He's just, you know, I think he processes things in his own way, in his own time. There's never been angst about it, you know. He was an ordinary teenager. He went off into his own world and he found me very annoying for a particular time of his life, and he's beyond that now, and we're very close, and we have a good relationship. And
you talked about your own time in school and being singled out as somebody who was different, and that the boys in the school twigged, as I use that word, that, mm-hmm. that you were gay. Did he have a problem with that in school? Did people know his father was gay? Did he tell them? You know, you told him at age 9, so he had another 9 years of school ahead of him at least to deal with that.
I mean, we were worried about that. There was no doubt about it. That was a worry for us because I took a job in the media. I became the editor of a gay magazine and spoke a lot about gay rights on you know, radio. And
you're currently the editor of Gay.
Of GCN Gay Community News. Yeah. And so I was worried that he would be identified. He went to an all-boys school as well. But luckily, there isn't a huge problem with bullying in the school. And he's a lot different to me. You know, yeah. He's quietly confident. I wasn't so confident when I was that age. And
that's something you can be proud of and his mother can be proud of as well. Because some of that comes from parents. How is he now?
He's great. He's living in Berlin. I think he's having a party every night.
Brian Finnegan talking to Shay Byrne on The John Murray Show on Monday. The Cort International Festival of Literature began in Galway this week, and on Tuesday night's Arena, Sean Rocks spoke to Julian Gough about his story, How to Fall in Love Properly, which is included in a book of short stories called Galway Stories, which was launched in conjunction with the festival.
When we came to Ireland, you know, we were living up a boreheen with grass down the middle of it. Our nearest neighbours were a bit of a walk away, and they had 13 children and raised cattle and had greyhounds pulling rabbits apart in the back Haggart, and you know, it was so Galway was quite a shock to the system. It was, you know, it was my New York, my Shanghai.
The story that you've written, Julian, is called How to Fall in Love Properly, about a young man called Jude. Is this observed or is this an experience?
It's very accurate and autobiographical in a lot of ways. I mean, I've disguised it as comedy, but it's pretty accurate, really. A lot of people that don't know Galway think it's, you know, some kind of Monty Python high comedy, you know, comic riff. And people who do know Galway say, oh, my God, I was there. I was getting flashbacks. So, you know, Galway life gets quite surreal, especially at night.
Well, this story is set in the nighttime. Maybe you'd read the opening section for us.
Sure. Slowed down a little by a stone in my shoe, I arrived in Galway City a while after dark. Galway City, the Sodom of the West. I reached the very crest of fabled Prospect Hill to see a bolt of lightning split the sky. Its white flash outlined a dark cloud of bats against the soaring tower of Galway's greatest building, the car park of the Roaches. I plunged down Prospect Hill toward the heart of the city, toward Eyre Square. Looking behind me, I saw I had shaken off the pursuing mob. I covered half of Eyre Square at a sprint, the next quarter of Eyre Square at a trot. I ambled through an eighth of Eyre Square, and I drifted to a halt with only a 16th of Eyre Square ahead of me. A distant church bell chimed the hour of 2 a.m. Between the first stroke and the second, the nightclubs of Galway disgorged their contents onto the streets. A crowd milled about me. I was spun around and around. A woman took me by the elbow. A man took a swing at me, and I spun and ducked and waltzed my way to the edge of the crowd. There, stunned, I beheld a tremendous transparent building, lit from within with golden light. Its splendour dominated the west side of the square. A building so vast and beautiful could only be a temple. And sure enough, through its walls of glass, I saw an enormous congregation facing a long, low altar behind which a priesthood seemed busy at their rituals. Outside it, young people milled about, many of them on their knees on the pavement, their heads bowed thoughtfully over what appeared to be modest food offerings. Glowing a fiery red above its teeming entrance was the word Supermax. As though hypnotized, I found myself drawn inside. And then I saw her. A vision, far ahead of me, wreathed in mist from her chip pan. The most beautiful girl in the world. And I realised this was a chip shop the size of Killaloe Cathedral. And I realised I was in love.
Julian Gough as heard on Tuesday's Arena. That's about my lot for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. To play us out, this is a song called Trampoline, which was performed live on Wednesday's Today with Pat Kenny by Birds of Chicago. So until the next time, goodbye.
Stung by the ride, so I'm floating like a bee. I'm floating home from a world away, clear to me. Spring is coming back to the land. It's only 4 degrees out, but I feel it's true. And I cannot find the moon. The stars are little pinpricks. Neither us is wounded, neither us is sick. Oh, everybody's wounded, everybody's sick. I say that neither one of us is wounded, neither us is sick. World gonna be so cruel to you, world gonna be so mean. I'm gonna catch you when you're falling through. I'm gonna throw you like a trampoline.
Throw me like a trampoline, skip me like a stone, shake me like a tambourine, and a little theft to start from. Oh, you don't know how the punches I can throw. It's all living to me. And dream me up a Palomino, put me down on that plane. I see there's a shadow moving across the lake. Step into a cool to you.